Hello everybody and welcome back to another week at the Dan Report. I'm John Adirola. We've got a big old show planned for you. In just a little bit, Jordan Yule is gonna be joining the show once again. We're gonna be breaking down the big news of the day, including what passes for unity from former leaders of the Democratic Party with a new set of attacks by Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders. The New York Times hyped up their endorsements. We're gonna break that down. And there was this massive pro-gun march down in Virginia. We're gonna be talking about that as well. Although I'm gonna keep it real, I wish I could just talk about like the SAG Awards, like because it was really interesting, and I'm not gonna do it. I'm not gonna talk for like an hour, but I will say, Parasite won for Best Ensemble Cast. If you haven't seen Parasite yet, go see it. It's been kind of a weak year for movies. Parasite was great. Knives Out, which was effectively snubbed at the SAG Awards, also great. Okay, politics is terrible, but there are some good bits of art out there if you go looking. So with that, we're gonna move on. Also, Jennifer Lopez should have won it. Sucks that she didn't. But anyway, we got stuff that we gotta talk about, so we're gonna go over here. Donald Trump is about to face the Senate impeachment trial. And in advance of it, his team called the entire thing rigged. And he's right, but like not in the way that he means. He means that like it's rigged against him when more than 50 senators have effectively said that they are going to turn off the free will center of their brain and just do whatever he wants. And even that's not enough for him. So as we launch into this, we do have some bits of news. Chuck Schumer's got a strategy to fight back against Mitch McConnell's rigging of the rules against people who want accountability or an actual free inquiry into what Donald Trump did. But before we get into all that, I just want to touch base with the American people because everybody is saying, here's what the people think. And every once in a while, it's nice to actually look at what the people think. Donald Trump says, nobody's interested in this. Turns out that's not actually true. And the Lev Parnas revelations of the past week apparently have nudged even more people in favor of Donald Trump being removed from office. There's a new CNN SSRS poll showed 51% of those surveyed want the Senate to make Trump the first president in US history to be convicted and forced out of office, compared to 45% who think the Senate should not do so. Now, compared to way back a couple months ago, that's moved about 4 points in the direction towards removal. It had been a minority position. Now it is a slight majority that want him to be removed from office. So just bear that in mind. Interestingly, there is a massive gender disparity on that question, with women favoring conviction and removal by a 59-38% divide, and men opposed to it, 52-42. That seems important. That's like we should think about that more going forward, how big of a gap there is politically between men and women. Seems important. But interestingly, I know that like the belief was this is sort of a sideshow, or it's gonna be forgotten because there are so many other big things happening. And I would have expected that too, but it turns out that no, despite how complex and fast moving the news cycle is these days, people do care about this and they are paying attention. 74% of respondents said they're either very closely or somewhat closely following the developments in the trial, which I mean, I would have to say at this point has got to be bad news for Donald Trump, because the latest sets of revelations coming out of Lev Parnas and all the Robert Hyde stuff has not been good for him. And it might be one reason that you have that slim majority wanting to be removed, but also you have people who are they're like curiosity has been piqued and they want to know more. And so the majority of respondents to CNN survey said they want the Senate to hear from more witnesses. That's 69% wanting fresh testimony, only 29% rejecting the idea. Which gets us down even lower than that like bare minimum Trump base that we often talk about. Like he doesn't even have all of them opposed to new testimony. It is still weird that like 1 out of 3 Americans are like, I don't want to learn anything. But sure, a lot have been, the well has been poisoned for many Americans against this entire process. But even Donald Trump's base, some of them are interested in finding out more. Although possibly that just means they want to see Hunter Biden up there, I don't know. Now, as I alluded to in the beginning of this, all that being true, the rules are set up in a way that it is unlikely that we will learn much if Mitch McConnell gets his way. Going into this, he wants there to be no witnesses, obviously. He's gonna try to pressure the critical mass of Republican senators to be opposed to that. So that's definitely true. They're gonna try to speed through this as fast as possible. Now, depending on who you talk to, that goal might be different, but we're looking at days or possibly weeks, and that's it. We're gonna be done with this thing very soon if Trump gets his way, and it looks like he probably will at this point. And when it comes to certain witnesses, even if we get them, that does not mean we're gonna know what they had to say. John Bolton is one of the few that we haven't heard directly from, also Lev Parnas. But when it comes to John Bolton, Donald Trump is apparently working behind the scenes to get Mitch McConnell to agree to, if they have Bolton testify, it will be in a closed session, it will be classified, and we might not find out anything that he actually said. Which is, as always, we need to acknowledge what you do when you are very, very innocent and there's nothing bad that he could reveal. I still don't even know what he could reveal because he was knocked out of this process relatively early on. But apparently he is considered such a wild card that they're trying to hide the entire thing if we actually get to the point of getting witnesses. And in terms of whether we'll have them, you know, we keep seeing updates that supposedly Mitt Romney is still keeping an open mind. Supposedly there's a few senators on the Republican side that are interested in finding out more. But I still find that very hard to believe. The electoral consequences for that will be fairly severe. And there are not that many people like Mitt Romney who are protected from those consequences. And so I would not be shocked if Chuck Schumer, who says, by the way, that he's going to be pressuring Democrats to fix these new rules, to force votes to make sure that we have a more a fairer trial. They want to see more documents related to the delayed aid. They want to fix some of these flaws or whatever. That doesn't mean it's going to happen. And I guess the most likely outcome at this point is, that we launch into this, we get a couple days of argumentation, and then that's really about it. We get everyone on the record, which is at the end of the day what we really wanted, but we won't necessarily learn anything more. That will be a huge dereliction of duty. Lev Parnas obviously needs to be grilled. Honestly, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, if you're a Republican, you should really want to know why Rudy Giuliani was running around with this guy and they were acting as unofficial diplomats for the United States, why they were enlisting the help of people like Robert Hyde. But that doesn't mean it's going to happen. Now, I want to jump to one other interesting topic involving this. Donald Trump has his legal team, and one of the most noteworthy members of it is Alan Dershowitz. Now, he cautions you, Dershowitz, that he's not a full member of the legal team. He's mostly just going to be adjudicating on what the Constitution has to say about what merits removal. Which is interesting because what he believes the Constitution says on removal has changed a lot over the years. So I want to take you back to the late 90s, back during the Clinton impeachment. Here is what Alan Dershowitz had to say about removing a president then.
It certainly doesn't have to be a crime. If you have somebody who completely corrupts the office of president and who abuses trust and who poses great danger to our liberty, you don't need a technical crime. Mm-hmm. But remember that because the executive power is vested in one person, the president, unlike the judicial power, which is vested in justices of the Supreme Court and inferior judges, or the legislative power in 100 senators and 400 and something representatives, we have one president. And to impeach a president is like a nonviolent revolution. It is the most dramatic act of undoing democracy that is possible. And that's why the framers used the term treason, bribery, high crimes and misdemeanors to suggest the English analogy to great offenses of state. We look at their acts of state. We look at how they conduct the foreign policy. We look at whether they try to subvert the Constitution the way Iran-Contra did by going behind the back of Congress, by lying repeatedly, and by misstating to the American public matters of great state issues. And we didn't impeach, and we shouldn't, frankly, if it were my view, we shouldn't have impeached the presidents for Iran-Contra. But it's not even a close question historically.
Okay, so not even a close question. That is amazing. Not only because he is directly firing back against this new idea that no, you have to have a very specific, narrowly defined crime. He was saying, no, just abuse of office and not being statesmanlike and abusing the trust and lying. All this general language, that's all you really need. And he even used Iran-Contra as an example, which is amazing because we just got out of a couple weeks of Mike Pompeo and Donald Trump and all of them lying constantly about the justification for us narrowly missing war with Iran. They kept lying about why they needed to do that strike. And so it couldn't have fit up more perfectly with what Alan Dershowitz was saying right there. But all you have to do is look at their behavior. It doesn't have to be a specific crime. And now he is going to go on the floor of the Senate and argue the exact opposite. So thankfully, Anderson Cooper actually asked him about that video. Here is his response.
Well, that's true. You don't need a technical crime. That's my position today. I've said right from the beginning, you need criminal-like behavior akin to bribery and treason. Remember that in the Clinton case—
That's not what you said then.
There was that's what I said then. It's what I said now. You don't need a technical crime.
You didn't say criminal-like behavior. You said companies complete corrupts the office of president and abuses trust and poses great danger.
Because the issue, that issue was not before anybody. Clinton, in the Clinton case, he was charged with a crime. Now the issue is whether or not you need criminal type behavior. I've done a lot more research. Back then, I took the word of many academics who said that.
So you're
I've
wrong,
now
then.
Done the research. No, I wasn't wrong. What I have a more sophisticated basis for my argument now, having read Justice Curtis's opinion and other opinions. It's very clear now that what you need is criminal-like behavior akin to bribery and treason. What is very clear is obstruction of justice, obstruction of Congress, or abuse of power.
Mind-blowing. Like, here is, I know this is going to seem weird. You expect that I'm going to talk about like Trump and impeachment or whatever. Here is one of the reasons why someone like Bernie Sanders is liked so much by his supporters. Because he is consistent and because he is honest. Because for most people in DC, that is what you get. It doesn't matter how directly they contradict themselves. They were never wrong. So what he's saying is he disagrees with himself in the 90s and he's right now. But he also wasn't wrong then. He's just more right now. He totally disagrees. Both were right. This is more right, even though they say directly opposite things. And this is why nobody trusts anybody in politics. Why can no one admit when they were wrong? Wrong now, wrong in the past. You say that you evolved, you have a more sophisticated understanding, but you were still right before it was more sophisticated. It is maddening the amount of sheer hypocrisy that is allowed. And it's good that like Anderson Cooper's calling him out for it, but does it really matter? Like the best we ever get in this system is that people who disagree with someone can acknowledge when they're being hypocritical. But unfortunately, most people are way too willing to give people a pass when it's someone they agree with, who's clearly changing their position opportunistically based on what's going on right now. That is what Alan Dershowitz is doing. And it's important because he's not just a generalized advisor to Donald Trump during this process. He is specifically coming on, purporting himself to be an expert in what the Constitution says about impeachment. And he can't seem to even decide for himself what it means. It is totally based on the partisan implications. You know, he wanted to get Clinton out, he doesn't want to get Trump out. And so the Constitution says whatever it has to say. It is pathetic. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Jordan Yule's gonna join us. We've got some massive stories to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
In one of the most frustrating ways to greet a new week, we had this news. Hillary Clinton decided to launch a broadside against Bernie Sanders right on the eve of the Iowa caucus for some reason. okay? And joining us to break this down, we're gonna give you all the quotes. Jordan Ewell, progressive activist, welcome back to the show.
John, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me, and I'm going to assume joining me in a bit of rage, because last week was not fun. This week looks like it's gonna be much the same.
Yeah, I mean, here we have another week starting off with the political establishment, the political elite attacking Bernie on like absolutely baseless claims, baseless grounds. Yet again, like the guy who stands to jeopardize the Democratic elite's control over the party, here they are just going all out trying to attack him. And I want to remind your viewers that you and I talked a few months ago about Obama in private saying that if there was anyone he was going to try to intervene to stop from getting the nomination, it was Bernie.
Yeah.
So now we have just a couple weeks out from Iowa, you have the 2016 nominee Hillary Clinton taking just like bald swipes at Bernie, trying to kneecap him. It's garbage.
So why don't we break down the two big things she said. So the first is this, and there's a lot in here. Nobody likes him. Nobody wants to work with him. He got nothing done. He was a career politician. It's all just baloney, and I feel so bad that people got sucked into it. So there, like I said, there's a lot there. So first of all, Bernie Sanders is a career politician. That's Hillary Clinton.
I mean, coming from the Clintons, it's laughable. Mm-hmm. Like there's like it's very few people or families represent career politicians and corrupt like oligarchic establishment presences in DC than the Clinton family. It's deeply ironic that of all criticisms for her to levy, that's one that she chose.
Mm-hmm. And look, in terms of nobody likes him, like you know that was trending. I like Bernie was trending. To the control room, I apologize. I'm going to jump around just a little bit, but here is what is so offensive about her making the claim nobody likes him. So we must acknowledge that Hillary Clinton, aside from Donald Trump, was like the least popular presidential candidate that's ever run. She wasn't the least popular, that's Trump, but she was pretty despised. Now, some of it, I think from the left was justified, it was based on policy. Some of the hatred against her historically on the right has been based on conspiracy theories and things like that. So it's a mix there, but you got to at least acknowledge that she's not very popular. Whereas Bernie Sanders, like, let's go to this. This is from all the way back in 2017. Bernie Sanders is the most popular US politician, even as some blame him for Clinton's loss. So that was all the way back in 2017. Just a couple days ago, Sanders is the most popular senator in the country. If we go to this next thing, he's got the highest favorability rating on the Democratic field right now, more so than actual Democrats like Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, and all of those. So like, do we not have to constrain what we say at all based on the facts? You don't like him is true. Him being unliked is simply not the case.
Right. Well, so there's two ways of looking at this. What you just pointed out is, do people generally like him? Do voters like him? Yes. I mean, he's raised more money than any other candidate on the left. He's got more individual donors than anybody. I mean, people love this guy. But what I think she was saying was people in Washington don't like him. The other politicians don't like him. And that is the point. That is why he is running, because this whole system is broken. Those people that she's talking about don't care about you or me or your viewers. They don't care about our interests. They're beholden to corporations. They take bribes from companies, and they're advocating for corporations' interests in Congress. They don't care about you. So when Hillary says that nobody likes Bernie, that's who she's talking about. She's talking about the people that she sees at cocktail parties, at fancy galas, that you or I or your viewers would never be invited to.
Yeah, well, I certainly won't be. I don't really get invited to anything. But anyway, so I'm gonna jump back a little bit, because well, look, her saying that he's unpopular, you know, she hates him. She hates him. She appears to hate him more than Trump. I get that. But this is what I think is an even worse statement and should have generated universal condemnation and has not yet. So she said, in response to a question about whether she would endorse and campaign for Mr. Sanders if he were to get the nomination, she said, I'm not going to go there yet. We're still in a very vigorous primary season. So she was given the opportunity to answer, like, if he's the nominee, it's going to be him versus Trump. Will you endorse and campaign for him? Which, let's acknowledge, like he did for her in 2016, and she declined that opportunity. What do you think about that?
I mean, this just really seems like she's not over 2016. She seems bitter and resentful that he dared get in the way of what many people in the Democratic establishment saw as a coronation, that it was her time and she had somehow earned it before elections even occurred. They're still upset about that. So there's only one right way to answer that question. Will you back Bernie if he's the nominee? Yes. That is the only answer, no matter who it is. If, as they say, Donald Trump is the greatest threat to democracy, the greatest threat to our country in recent history or ever, if you are sitting on the sidelines during the general election, you're part of the problem. So there's only one way to answer that, and it's yes.
Which he, of course, has done. And I've said, you know, I like Bernie way more than all the other candidates, but I will campaign for Bennett if it's a Bennett nomination. Ain't gonna be, but I would. Now look, he was reached out to, and he gave a couple of different responses. So he released a statement saying, "My focus today is on the monumental moment in American history, the impeachment trial of Donald Trump. Together, we're gonna go forward and defeat the most dangerous president in American history." So they're a very responsible response. And again, he has never been willing to attack her in any sort of vicious way or untrue way or unfair way. Even in direct response to her attacking him, he brings it back to the substance and what they should be able to agree on.
Yeah, I mean, he's guilty of, again, being just a good, decent guy. I don't know if you saw the other statement. Someone from NBC News asked him, "Hey, why is Hillary still talking about 2016? And Bernie's response was, "I don't know. It's a good question. Go ask her."
Yeah.
Like, just come on. Just drop it. Get over it. Move on.
Well, hold on. Before we move on, there is one other great response. So Jeff Bennett asked Sanders for his reaction to saying no one likes him. He said, "On a good day, my wife likes me. So let's clear the air on that one." He then pivoted talking about impeachment. That's a good response.
Smart.
And at the end of the day, I mean, that's mission one. You got to keep that true, and then you're golden.
Exactly. Because if you don't have that, you have nothing.
Okay. So look, if you'll stick around, there's several other stories we got to get to. Obviously, we had a lot to say about this, but we're gonna take a short break, and then Jordan and I are gonna break down the New York Times double endorsement after this. Okay, so to the extent that any newspaper presidential endorsement matters, I guess if one was going to, it would be the New York Times. And they seem to get that. So they dragged this process out day after day, building up the hype, releasing teaser trailers. And that meant that everyone had a bunch of days to try to predict who would they support. Would it be, you know, a fairly obvious one, like a Biden or a Warren? Would they really throw a curveball, do like a Bloomberg or a Sanders? And in the end, they did something that almost no one could have predicted, a dual endorsement of Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren. But it turns out that somebody did predict it. Take a look at this tweet from earlier in the day where it was revealed. Jordan Eula tweeted, "Tired, New York Times endorses Biden. Wired, New York Times endorses Pete. Inspired, New York Times endorses Warren and Klobuchar at the same time." Turned out he was onto something. And now he's also on our show. How's it going, Jordan?
John, it's going great. Thank you for having me.
Was that just a total joke, or did you actually think there was any chance of that double endorsement?
I'm going to leave that part up to, you know, the viewer's imagination. But it just, I can't actually believe that happened.
So let's briefly say, they said, their basic argument was, right now there is a fight between the pragmatists and the like idealists or whatever, which I think is not a fair description of what's actually going on. But if that's what they believe, then they want to pick one from each of those camps. So that's what they did. What do you think about that strategy?
It's just the ultimate both sides approach for the New York Times. It's just like, here's two candidates with wildly different platforms. We endorse both of them. They're just refusing to make a choice. And I saw some questions, fair questions, I think, being raised on Twitter, where people were saying, if you can't pick one, why are you even making this endorsement yet? And the suggestion was that they were forced into this on this rigid timeline because of that TV production schedule for that show on FX. It just seemed, if that's the case, it just seems a little like journalistic malpractice, and maybe just you didn't really need to do that. But mostly my takeaway was this was a both sides move, a false equivalence, and just, you know, they should have just waited until they had one concrete person that they stood behind. This was kind of a weak move.
Yeah, if it was because of a production schedule, that's just about the worst explanation I can think of. If you want us to believe that you take any responsibility for what you are obviously pitching as this big important choice to the amount that you hyped it, for it to be held captive to a release schedule like that is ridiculous. And look, I was playing devil's advocate, but I at least said what their argument is, that you have these dueling camps. When is that not true? When is a primary field all people who agree fundamentally on everything about the future of the party? That's always going to be the case. And so even inside of their justification, this is a massive dereliction of duty. Now, at the end of the day, how much does it really matter? Do you think that like Klobuchar or Warren are going to get a big boost out of this?
No, I think these endorsements matter very little. The people that would sincerely read the New York Times endorsement and allow it to inform their voting preference, like you could probably count on like one hand. I imagine they all live on the Upper West Side and go to the same cocktail parties. Like people who treat politics purely as sport, like some horse race rather than, for many people, a matter of life and death.
Yeah.
It's just the New York Times endorsement generally does not predict the winner. They haven't really seen a bump in Klobuchar's polling whatsoever. She's going to get knocked out probably after New Hampshire or Nevada. It doesn't really have much of an impact. And Warren is also on a slope downward. Excuse me, after last week, she just didn't really have the strongest week. So I don't think this will make a huge impact. It's more of just a spectacle. But one thing I do want to point out that you said earlier, like they frame this as a war is between two competing camps. You could say that about the general election as well.
Yeah.
So are we going to see both endorse the Republican and the Democratic nominee at the same time?
Yeah, it's like they're like the over enthusiastic, like mom in the stands yelling, "You're all winners." No,
we just hope they all
can't all be.
Yeah.
Oh God. Okay. Anyway, I just want to briefly acknowledge one thing because you mentioned last week. So I did see, I don't know if you saw the video, if it was at some event, but Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren sort of walking arm in arm, commiserating and laughing. It's just funny after how vicious and vitriolic like the conversation about that whole thing was, and they're just like apparently back to friends or whatever, or at least that's what they want to project.
Yes, I think again, largely this was just a product of CNN trying to manufacture a scandal because they had the debate. I don't think that reflected any sort of deep divide between the two. I'm happy we got that moment because it shows that the Progressive Alliance is there. And as we saw, The Intercept reported also last week that Bernie's camp had previously been looking into whether Warren could serve as VP and Treasury Secretary.
Yeah.
So I don't think this bridge has really burned, maybe bruised some egos, but largely overall, I think they're okay. And I was relieved to see that as well.
Yeah, I was too. And then we can turn back to the primary because we only have a couple of weeks until the first big races. Okay, we're going to take another break. We come back, more big news to get to after this. In anticipation of a big gathering in Virginia this weekend, there was concern that it could turn violent, and thankfully that did not end up happening. Thousands of gun owners and gun rights supporters gathered Monday at Virginia's Capitol for a peaceful day to address our legislature that appeared to generate none of the violence feared by some state leaders. You might have seen photos and videos going around on social media. Many demonstrators opposed to proposed gun restrictions openly displayed military-style semi-automatic rifles. Others wore orange "Guns Save Lives" stickers. Some had signs like things like "Come and Take It," "Second Amendment Sanctuary," or one said, "We come semi-unarmed this time," which is a bit of a mixed message there. But thankfully, there appears to have been no violence. We're joined once again by progressive activist Jordan Ewell to comment. Jordan, what did you think about the gathering?
So first, thanks for having me, John. I think that just looking at like the reporting and the coverage on this event, it really looked like a bunch of like create a player characters from like a low rent Call of Duty knockoff. You saw a bunch of guys like cosplaying as like troops, people who really thought they were like tougher and bigger than they were. But ultimately, these types of demonstrations are just like these people are just useful idiots for gun manufacturers and their lobbyists because these are then used as kind of cudgels to kind of beat back sensible legislation that could lead to gun violence prevention or just sensible, reasonable restrictions or safeguards on people making impulse purchases. Mm. No one's taking their guns, but you know, there, in the future, there could be some sort of like law or rule regarding like, you know, background checks or how much you can buy and how soon and often and with what frequency you can buy guns or ammo. But these people are just basically hapless stooges for gun manufacturers to blockade that so they could continue increasing revenue.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously, there was so much misinformation used to generate this gathering. And what I saw that worried me the most was Donald Trump, like repeatedly, like he tweeted as they were like gearing up to start it, just like USA, USA in all caps. And he was talking about how they're going to take away your rights. Like there's concern that some of these people might start some violent incident. And Donald Trump appeared to be trying to encourage that to happen. But the way you described it right there, I think is so accurate. Like, I might think that like dressing up like a barbarian and wearing a broadsword is cool, but like I don't actually think that makes me look tough. And this is the only form of cosplay that they really do think is cool. Like that you wear like a skull bandana and it's like, hey, it's like that character in Modern Warfare, but you're not that person. Like I don't, the lack of self-awareness, I think swords are cool. I don't walk around with a sword. I expect that minimal level of self-awareness. And these people, they craft an entire identity around being able to possess a gun and try to intimidate people with it.
Right. Yeah, it's people who for the most part probably could not even pass a physical fitness test to become a mall security guard have convinced themselves that they're the last thing standing between us and tyranny. That they go out and put on their like cosplay gear and pretend they're troops.
Yeah, and you know, like so obviously we're to some extent joking around, but also that like you could strap on an assault rifle and put skulls and stuff like that, and not just think that you're tough, but think that you're the good guy in this, that like you pretending to be a soldier to get in people's faces, like that you are on the right side of history. And as the ultimate example of this, I wanna show you this little bit of footage of the InfoWars armored vehicle rolling down the block. Okay, so and again, that he like they believe they're the good guys. They're rolling down the block in a vehicle that they have no reason to have, shouting about how they're gonna crush tyrants under their heels because the people of Virginia voted in support of reasonable gun control.
Yeah, I mean, Alex Jones is just he loves theatrics and optics. This is his thing. He's just like, you know, kind of the conspiracy equivalent of a professional wrestler. This is all kayfabe for him. But I think one other clip that was circulating that people should definitely go check out, Sebastian Murdoch of Huffington Post confronted Alex and asked him to talk about how he has been forced to pay the families of Sandy Hook victims, that Alex had led a crusade against and has smeared continually and claimed that never happened. It was a false flag. Alex obviously had nothing to say about that. Really good clip. So Sebastian Murdoch, great job of Huffington Post.
Yeah, definitely go take a look at that. Okay, with that, why don't we turn to a very different story. Journalist Glenn Greenwald is facing charges stemming from supposed activities in Brazil. We want to give you this rundown because this has been breaking all throughout the morning. Federal prosecutors in Brazil on Tuesday charged American journalist Glenn Greenwald with cyber crimes for his role in the spreading of cell phone messages that have embarrassed prosecutors and tarnished the image of an anti-corruption task force. In a criminal complaint, prosecutors accused him of being part of a criminal organization that hacked into the cell phones of several prosecutors and other public officials last year. They say Mr. Greenwald did more than merely receive the hacked messages and oversee the publication of newsworthy information. For instance, prosecutors contend that Mr. Greenwald encouraged the hackers to delete archives that had already been shared with The Intercept Brazil in order to cover their tracks. And then Mr. Greenwald was communicating with the hackers while they were actively monitoring private chats on Telegram, a messaging app. Well, I mean, if it's coming from the authorities in Brazil, I think we should probably just accept it at face value, Jordan.
Right. I mean, the Brazilian government, Bolsonaro's regime, is like one of the most corrupt governments on the planet right now. He has been after Greenwald for months. He has singled Greenwald out for his reporting. This is just, you know, fascist bullying tactics trying to silence him. It's a threat to freedom of the press. Like, everyone needs to get behind Glenn Greenwald. And one thing I do want to point out is there is a lot of people who are trying to use this and kind of hedging in their comments. Like, well, you know, Glenn's been really mean to me. Glenn, I don't agree with Glenn's. Like, shut up. No one cares. Log off. Like, you defend him or you don't. You don't need to make this about yourself. No one cares what Glenn tweeted at you. You defend this because it's the right thing to do. And this is a threat to free speech. And Glenn Greenwald is braver than most of the other bloggers hemming and hawing about how they've been tweeted at by him over the past few years.
Yeah. You're not being asked to defend him for being a nice guy or for being productive all the time or whatever. Yeah. You're supposed to stand against a fascist government, which is going against journalists who are trying to hold it accountable. That seems like something we should all be able to agree on. Now, really fast, I want to read some of what Glenn Greenwald put out as a response to this. He said, the Bolsonaro government and the movement that supports it has made it repeatedly clear that it does not believe in basic press freedoms. Less than 2 months ago, the federal police, examining all the same evidence cited by the public ministry, said what is clear to any rational person, I did nothing more than do my job as a journalist, ethically and within the law. This denunciation is an obvious attempt to attack a free press in retaliation for the revelations we reported about Minister Moro and the Bolsonaro government. We will not be intimidated by these tyrannical attempts to silence journalists. And this is, look, obviously, it sucks that the government is so openly and transparently trying to attack a free press. But this provides an opportunity for everyone to come together in defense of something that should not be complicated. It should not be up for debate. And unfortunately, some people just will not be able to rise to that level, that minimal bar.
Yeah, it's a pretty easy bar to clear. But you've got people who, again, are upset with how he sees the Russiagate story and how he has, you know, his punditry around that and are conflating it with everything about him in the story, which they're totally distinguishable. He has been steadfast in his criticism and reporting on the fascist regime in Brazil. He has spoken openly about it. And for that, he's, you know, now subject to personal attacks, threats to his safety. He's been threatened privately by private citizens in Brazil. He's had far-right pro-Bolsonaro reporters physically attack him in interviews. Glenn is a courageous reporter. We have to stand with him. This cannot stand.
I could not agree more. Jordan, as always, thank you so much for joining us. And even more so on today's episode than usual. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Davos is going on. And Greta Thunberg is not, she's not, I guess, holding back in her attacks against those she sees as being insufficiently in support of what's necessary to stop the climate crisis. We're going to have some awesome bits of her speech after this. We are in dark political times, and the list of people that give me any amount of hope for the future is down to like a handful. But one of them is Greta Thunberg, and she is off in Davos in Switzerland right now at the World Economic Forum. And she is trying once again to light a fire under the butts of those who can't seem to recognize that the world is on fire. So we're going to play some sections of her speech. It is a great one. Here first is part of her introduction.
The fact that the USA is leaving the Paris Accord seems to outrage and worry everyone. And it should. But the fact that we are all about to fail the commitments you signed up for in the Paris Agreement doesn't seem to bother the people in power even the least. Any plan or policy of yours that doesn't include radical emission cuts at the source starting today is completely insufficient for meeting the 1.5 or well below 2 degree commitments of the Paris Agreement. You say children shouldn't worry, You say, just leave this to us. We will fix this. We promise we won't let you down. Don't be so pessimistic. And then, nothing. Silence. Or something worse than silence. Empty words and promises which give the impression that sufficient action is being taken.
And so this is, I think, one of the most important and productive things that Greta is doing. And it mimics a lot of what she said not long ago in Portugal. It is that, yes, we can acknowledge that certain countries are not getting on board, and that is a problem. We have to put pressure on countries like the United States to actually rejoin the Paris Climate Accords. But far more importantly, we need to make sure that those who did, the vast majority, almost all the countries in the world, that them being in it actually means something, and they don't use supposed participation in something like the Paris Climate Accords to then provide sort of a cloak under which they can continue to basically go about things that they always did. I don't know how much longer people are going to care what Greta says and listen to her, but she is using the time that she has as wisely as she can. It is to put pressure on people that want to like shake her hand and smile at her in rooms like that, and then go back to their countries and resume the same sorts of self-destructive economic activities that have gotten us to the place we're in right now. And she might be burning bridges, I guess, but that's what's necessary to hopefully inspire the people in those countries to oust those politicians, those who say that they accept climate science, but then won't actually do what's necessary to solve the problem. And so we turn now to solutions. Here are some of what she wants to see done right now.
We demand at this year's World Economic Forum, participants from all companies, banks, institutions, and governments immediately halt all investments in fossil fuel exploration and extraction, immediately end all fossil fuel subsidies, and immediately and completely divest from fossil fuels. We don't want these things done by 2050, 2030, or even 2021. We want this done now. It may seem like we are asking for a lot, and you will, of course, say that we are naive. But this is just the very minimum amount of effort that is needed to start the rapid sustainable transition.
I'm sure that a lot of people sort of coming into this conversation right now, if they hear the list of things that she defines as the minimum necessary to start a response, they must think that that seems radical, but she's 100% right. All of those things are eminently doable. Not just, you know, using the power of government to, you know, move us to renewable energy and things like that, but stop actively aiding and propping up these industries that are killing our civilization. That seems like that would be really easy, and yet those subsidies remain in a number of countries. Every one of those recommendations that she gave is 100% doable, and to the extent that they seem radical, it boggles my mind that we can't look at what we're facing coming up in 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, and not see that as far scarier than a bit of short-term economic damage that eventually will be replaced by new industries, you know, in renewable energy and things like that. It seems maddening to me, and thankfully she reflects that. Now, she saved her harshest commentary for the end. Here's how she closed her comments to Davos.
I wonder, what will you tell your children was the reason to fail and leave them facing a climate chaos that you knowingly brought upon them? That it seemed so bad for the economy that we decided to resign the idea of securing future living conditions without even trying? Our house is still on fire. Your inaction is fueling the flames by the hour. And we are telling you to act as if you loved your children above all else.
And that is not at all unfair. Like it would be stupid enough if they were willing to barter our future for economic gains in the future. But the thing is, we're not gonna get either, okay? You know what's bad for the economy? Flooding and wildfires and terrible disasters. That's what's bad for it. Okay, that's all the time we have, unfortunately. We'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.